plug. So our guest, this morning, is Richard Strozzi-Heckler. He's a six-degree black belt in Aikido and has a PhD in psychology. He's nationally known as a speaker, coach, and consultant on leadership and mastery, and he's the president of Strozzi Institute, which offers consulting and coaching to individuals and companies worldwide. He's been featured in the Wall Street Journal for leadership programs, one of the top 50 executive coaches. He's also been an advisor to NATO and the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, and works with U.S. Special Operations Command in a somatic approach to counterterrorism. And most recently, he's the author of The Leadership Dojo, which is the last of his 7 books. So, Richard, thank you so much for joining us here this morning.
You're very welcome. Good to be here.
Great. Well, let's just jump right in. The title of the talk is Embodied Leadership, the Mastery of Three Domains. And embodied leadership is really at the core of what you do. And I'm wondering if you could just differentiate between embodied leadership and more traditional forms of leadership.
I think that the essential way to look at it is that when we refer to embodied leadership, we talk about the difference between just having an idea or an insight or a concept about something and the capacity to take a new action. And that capacity to take a new action, which really means that we're learning, is that we've engaged in a set of practices that allows us to shift or modify ourselves so that when we move into our leadership position, which is either having followers or leading our own lives, is that we can become different actors, have different ways of being, distinct from I have a good idea about something.
So what are some of the, in terms of the leadership that we're evolving into, what you're calling embodied leadership, you know, there's a lot of old patterns of leadership and then there that we need to let go of. I'm wondering if you could share a bit about some of the ideas of what it means to be a leader or habits that we've inherited that may not be not really serve as we enter a new era.
I think the one of the essential or ground things we're looking at here in embodied leadership is that there's a long tradition of inheriting and adopting a notion that we will leave our moods and emotions at the door, and then we will come in and, in terms of being a good fulfiller or instrumental means, trying to get the job done. And what's been very clear is that leaving our moods and emotions aside has been a big cost for us. And it's been a cost in both physical health and mental health, and also in creativity and innovation and productivity. So a real ground is the notion of switching from the thinking self to the feeling self. And this doesn't mean that we won't be able to think clearly or analyze something clearly or to speculate about the future. All that will be in place, but that we'll also get the intelligence that lives just below our chin, too. Instead of our chin up in our heads, we begin to contact these other brains in our heart and in our gut. And what that requires is to identify with what we're feeling. And I want to be clear here is that I don't mean feeling in the sense of you have a feeling or you have an emotion. That could come out of it. But what's really critical is this idea that we contact the animating force or the chi or the ki or the elan vital, the prana, that actually animates us. And what we say is that energy that moves through us is the repository of about 3 billion years of intelligence and wisdom. And that adds a lot to our journey as men and leadership.
And for folks who might think that these some of the concepts only apply to kind of, you know, the leading edge, really super new paradigm kind of activities, I mean, you're doing this work and talking about these principles in special forces, for instance, you know, very, very traditionally masculine, powerful kind of arenas, and that they're using that as part of the counterterrorism. And I'd love to have you share a bit more about, in working in an arena like that, what are some of the core insights into the evolution of the masculine that have emerged?
Yes. Let me go back with a little background. Was it in mid-80s, we, the Institute, we did a a program at the Army Special Forces that we use, codenamed the Trojan Warrior Project. And it was classified at the time, but basically they were looking for physical enhancements, mental enhancements, and team cohesion. And one officer actually said, we're really actually looking for a holistic soldier. And so we spent 6 months doing a program that included meditation, physical fitness, redesigning that in terms of stretching and stress reduction. We did Aikido every day. We did communication skills. We took all of these things into their training and their operations and showed a huge, huge leap in what they were doing, both anecdotally and quantitatively. And so that was back in 85, and it really produced quite a stir and then took our work into other areas like with the Navy SEALs and Marine Recon, et cetera, et cetera. But I tell this story because I'm now getting more and more calls from special operations people who read the book and are saying, this is something that we have to revisit. So both, it's very edifying because what we started back in 85, I think, is just starting to take root. And it's also surprising that the fundamental and simple message, one of the fundamental and simple messages of that program and of the book is that the if we start to contact, as I said before, the intelligence that is not only our cognitive thinking self, but also our intuition, how we move well with others, coordinate effectively with others, that whole part of our nervous system that lives from our chin down, which requires us to feel more, has more and more of a place in terms of the modern military. So the this notion, I mean, the other part of this notion around what would people now call counterinsurgency or counterterrorism is that people are starting to understand that what's important here is that we how do we build relationships? How do we build relationships with the world in a way where they start to see that we're effective partners? That's really different than taking out or killing certain terrorists. You know, I mean, we say that yes, we would need people like that crash indoors, but it's not going to be sufficient. So how do we build a warrior archetype, a warrior mentality inside of our military that can be act effectively and swiftly and strongly, but also has a skill set for developing connection and relationships with others? You know, I had one of the sheikhs in Iraq told me, he said, when people come to see me, he said, what I really look for is the error that they are. And what he meant by that in Arabic was the notion that what is the mood or what is the energy state that somebody's in. And if they feel like somebody's just trying to pass an agenda upon them and do something, they're just dismissed right away. So that's one of the things we're beginning to look at.
Interesting. Yeah, so it's almost like the traditional or more traditional vision of what a warrior looks like just isn't really adequate to today's world. Is that you need to have a greater level of embodied sensitivity, emotional mastery, relational sensitivity in order to be an effective warrior. So there's kind of an evolution of the archetype, it seems.
Absolutely. And I'm going to talk about this notion here, that archetype of the warrior, because I think one of the things that is we're really mandated to do and need to be bring a certain rigor to is that what is the images that all of us, men and women and men, but the young men that are coming up of what it means to be a man and a man as a warrior. And these images that we get from the movies and from the media, TV, really are, they're trivializing and they're patronizing and condescending to us. And they continue this whole notion that we can be, we can act without fear, and we have all these machines that we are connected to, almost like androids. And by doing this, we'll achieve some level of warriorship and mastery. And It's deeply disturbing that this image is what's being supplanted in the nervous system of the culture. And so it's not only like on an individual level, I think, that there has to be a transformation among men, but we have to really rigorously face into the system that keeps feeding these images and are unreflectively swallowing them and digesting them and taking them in.
So how is your so you're a 6-degree black belt in Aikido, and I'm curious, like, how much has that training in martial arts influenced your vision of what being a warrior means, and how has it done so?
Everywhere and every place. I started martial arts when I was young, when I was about 13. So I've been doing it well over 50 years. I still do it. I still have a teacher. I still practice and teach. And went through the ranks of judo and jiu-jitsu, karate. I taught hand-to-hand combat in the Marine Corps. And been married to Aikido for 40 years now. Next year it'll be 40 years. And essentially, you know, Stephen, it informs everything that I do, absolutely everything that I do. And there's a very pivotal concept in Aikido that I think that the world is really ready for. And conversationally, in America, we call it the blend, or blending, which means that when somebody attacks you or comes at you, is that what you do is you blend or you join with their energy and work with the energy that way. And in Aikido, it's called the Aiki, being in harmony with energy or with ki, takemusu, Aiki. And I believe that move that we do in Aikido, that blending move, which comes in every technique that we do, is actually an evolutionary move. You know, what is factory loaded in us? Is it under pressure? Whether his opponent will either fight, will flee, or will disassociate, or appease, fight, flight, disassociate, or appease. And we say these are factory loaded. These come with the human body and the human mind. And by practicing the notion of the blend inside of an attack coming, I believe and would submit that we're actually beginning to shift at some very deep level cellular and maybe even genetic or DNA patterns, you know. And, you know, in the conversational space, what it means is that we are, when we blend with somebody, we're listening deeply to them and we're legitimatizing them. And the great technology of neuroscience now says that what's fundamental to the human brain, despite culture, despite geography, class, race, color, is that people are monitoring always for connection and belonging. And that happens well before even the child is sitting up vertically. So what we can count on is that when we blend with somebody, we produce in them the perception and the assessment, oh, this person is listening to what I'm saying. They're not just trying to drive their agenda. They're legitimatizing my point of view and are willing to work with me in it. A huge ground that can be built, so that we can, instead of taking conflict, which I would say presume conflict, instead of conflict going into violence, conflict can go into a generative interpretation of creativity, for example. And this idea of blending and listening from a centered place, that doesn't mean acquiescing, it doesn't mean giving up, it doesn't mean forfeiting your position. You still are centered in and embodying what is important to you, your ethics, your morals. And you see across from you is a human being with their own set of concerns that come out of their own set of historical background. So it's not a giving up, but it's really allowing yourself in that moment to be in their shoes. You know that great line from To Kill a Mockingbird where Jeremy Finch said to his daughter, Scout, he said, you never really know a person until you're in their shoes. And instead of that really being a homily or like a bumper sticker, we know now that that's actually one of the fundamental things that human beings are monitoring, are searching for. And through a community of practices, for mine, one of mine, for example, would be the Aikido Dojo, where people come together daily and practice Aikido and practice this idea of blending in a very rigorous, robust, and ethical way, is that that begins to shift the nervous system. That begins to shift the spirit, if you will, so that we have this whole other evolutionary way of being and choice besides fighting or fleeing or disassociating.
One of the things that I remember from my Aikido training is how important being able to cultivate that centeredness in the hara, the kind of the lower energy centers, and be really grounded and rooted so that from that place you can more effectively blend and work with other people's energy rather than getting kind of tossed around. I'm wondering if, for those who are not actually doing Aikido training, if you have recommendations for how to kind of find that centering place and ground so that you can do more of the blending and sort of, instead of meeting opposition with opposition, to be able to kind of transform a situation.
This notion of centering that we can appropriate from the martial arts, it can be practiced in a number of different ways. And you know, the great advantage to it, it's non-equipment intensive. And essentially what you're doing, and you can do it any place, any time, is dropping the attention from the thinking self, from the head, where you were projecting into the future, or we're lamenting the past, or we're caught in a circular domain of thinking, is we drop the attention to about 2 inches below the belly button. That's what the Japanese call hara, or the Chinese tantian. That's the center of gravity of the human form. And once we drop our attention down, we can then say, I'm also going to relax. Relaxing, again, isn't just a homily or a good idea, but you could think, I'm going to relax my eyes or my jaw, let my shoulders drop, let the breath drop. And then look out to the world from that point of view. And incidentally, I'll say is that when we do center, when we're balanced along length and our width and our depth in our bodies, and our attention is dropped, it's clinically impossible to be anxious. So in one way, that's the price of admission right there. Because what anxiety...
You can put that different. So anxiety is a symptom of being out of our center.
That's one way to say it. That would be one way to say it. You know, in the DSM manual, what anxiety is described is that, you know, the breath is high and it's quick. There's a low grade contraction in the body, and we're caught in these circularity of thoughts and the fear about what may happen. So centering practice actually is a medicine for anxiety, and it's from center then all these other actions can take place. And like what I said, included the whole notion of blending.
Great. I mean, and how does this relate to, you work with a lot of Fortune 500 executives and people who are playing leadership roles in the world, so how do some of these principles apply to how we show up in leadership roles?
Well, in what I want to say, when we talk about leadership and we talk about leadership behaviors or principles or virtues, you know, if we look back, we realize like they're the same things that were said in Plato's Republic, or they were said in the Bhagavad Gita. In other words, they really are virtues and principles that really make a exemplary human being. And we make a big to-do about leadership, but really what we're talking about is how can we become more complete human beings. And if we center ourselves, like I described, I just described it physically, and linguistically, because we're also linguistic beings. We're biological, we're linguistic, we're social, and we're historical beings. And the way we center ourselves linguistically is we ask ourselves, for the sake of what am I taking these actions? For the sake of what am I speaking this way? For the sake of what am I listening this way? And that way we begin to unite our vision of the world and how we want to appear to the world and how that shows up in our presence. And that would be, you know, when we it's a little bit of a fatigued word, but essentially that's one of the things that is the mind-body connection, that there is a, what comes out of our mouth is coherent with the actions that our body is doing. So I'll work with people in positions of power where their shoulders will be up around their ears, or they'll be chewing on their jaws, and their jaws are rippling, and that's invisible to them. And what they don't see is that when they talk about generating a certain mood in their organization, they don't embody that for themselves. The words come out that way, but when somebody looks at them, they would say, this person is actually quite tense or quite anxious or quite pushed forward, and what they're saying doesn't make sense as it comes out of them, and there's a question, is this somebody I'd want to follow?
And even from my time in Aikido, there's a quality of you're actually affecting the field of energy around you, and so even if you don't see those things subliminally, if there's turmoil beneath the surface, then that's going to be affecting teams, organizations, without you even knowing.
Even though we live pretty much in a disembodied culture, the organism picks up on these things, either very explicitly or implicitly. And a very simple example would be, so many people walk around with their heads forward. Let's say that's a cause from overthinking or staring into a computer screen or typing. But their head is forward, and with their head is forward, gravity has a greater field to pull on because of that, the field of the chin and the neck. And if we're fighting gravity, the other person looking would have this whole notion of, well, this is a person that's in a fight. And I say it could be very explicit or implicit. And if we look at somebody in this way and go, they're actually fighting internally, they're in an internal struggle. And I don't mean in a virtuous way, like they're struggling with something important, but they're just fighting the field of the planet, which is gravity, is that we would be more hesitant to follow them. And we'd be more hesitant to be mobilized and motivated by them. And very simple things about how do I align my energy field with the energy field of the planet goes a long, long ways in building credibility and trust.
That's very, it's subtle, but very important, and it really brings awareness to these deeper domains of our being and how much that's affecting other people's perceptions of us. So.
And I think, Stephen, is that the notion is that when we talk about the subtlety of it, which is very common, we also, I think, that reflects our really disembodied living, because if you look at it in some way, it's not subtle at all, that we stand on 2 feet and we're upright. And if somebody's head is cocked to one side, or the pelvis is cocked, or we're leaning forward, it's fairly obvious. And it's just not in our optic to notice that. And once we notice it, we begin to see it really everywhere. And, Albert Mehrabian, who is a professor emeritus at UCLA, almost 40 years ago did a longitudinal study about what makes somebody credible. That was the question. And over all these years, long-term studies in different cultures, basically what kept appearing is that people will listen 7% content, 7% content, and 93% presence, composure, comportment, rhythm, and sound of voice. Now, we find people credible because they keep their promises, but this also really represents how important it is, our presence is, and how we self-organize ourselves somatically.
It kind of speaks to this deeper question of what is the role of somatics for men in the first part of the 21st century now?
Yeah, somatics, maybe I'll just say a few things about this, is a Greek word, and it predates Cartesian thinking of a mind-body split, but we could roughly translate it as the living body in its wholeness. We can thank Thomas Hanna, who was the editor of Somatics Magazine, for that term, the living body in its wholeness, which basically means the human form contains our acting, our thinking, our feeling, and our perception, and our spiriting. And that's all inside the human form. And it's only through a rationalistic way of looking at the world that have we separated all those things. And so a somatic way of being in the world means that we're acting from a unity, and the notion of separating how we feel or how we think or what we perceive are really conceits of language, and that they're really all happening as coming from a whole or coming from a unity. And this is one of the, somatics is one of, I believe, one of the most powerful technologies as we move into the, really the beginning of the 21st century, is that while we need systemic change, that we're also looking at individual change and practices that bring in that unity so that we are actually retraining our nervous system or retraining our spirit, as you will, are really what's ground for any kind of transformation that we have. And I think it's important for us to remember that to have body memory takes about 300 repetitions, and embodiment, that something actually is part of us and it becomes who we are, takes about 3,000 repetitions. And I say that from the really importance of being in a community of practitioners. Now, that could be a martial art. It could be people doing their physical training, walking, running, doing weights. It could be something like Qigong, could be yoga. There's a number of things like that, that if we think that we're practicing not just for physical fitness or self-defense, but really practicing for the cultivation of the self, that we have a really great chance of reshaping and reorganizing ourselves in new ways. And I think especially for men, where the violence thing with men, we just haven't got our hands around. And this is an essential piece. And I would say that one of the reasons that most conflict these days, one of the reasons that it leads to violence, is that because we have separated ourselves from our feeling self or our somatic self.
Great. Let's get a question, or probably only have time for one question, but if you have on the live maestro call, just touch one and let's take a question, or if you're on the webcast as well, we can type that in. Let's go with Peter, you're live.
Hi, yes. Thank you very much for this call. It's been very insightful. One question I did want to ask you is to just touch briefly on the concept of how to harness that anxiety that you were talking about, the upper breathing. And what I've been doing in the past is accepting it, and then basically realizing, okay, I'm anxious right now, and trying to get comfortable in that state of mind and that feeling. But you did mention something about how to combat it and alleviate the anxiety. I wonder if you could maybe just expand on that concept just a little bit more.
Tell me if this is useful, Peter. Is that first of all, so much of that battle is won by you because you're noticing it, you're naming it, and you recognize that it's not going to take you into the future that in which you want to go. So after that, one thing you can do is see where your breath is and then lower your breath. So the system's designed so that the breath happens in the abdomen. If the breath is high, it will just produce anxiety. Look to where in your body that there's the pivotal place in which you would be holding. Some of the usual suspects would be eyes, jaw, shoulder, breath, as I said. And what we'll find is usually there's one place that is kind of the keystone of that kind of holding. And once we let that go, the entire body begins to relax. The third thing is the system is designed, the body, so that the mass or the weight is held not by the muscular system but by the skeletal system. So it's beginning a practice of feeling, sensing, or even in the beginning imagining that your weight can be rest on your skeleton, rest on your bones. And that brings you much more into harmony with gravity. It brings you much more into harmony with the system as it is, and by doing these things are the practice that help alleviate anxiety.
Okay, thank you.
Great.
Is that useful?
Yes.
Good.
Well, we're almost at the end of our time here together. Richard, you're a fountain of information and insight. I love what you have to share. And I'm wondering if for folks who'd like to stay in contact with you or know about upcoming events, I know you have a website, StrozyInstitute.com. You want to say anything more about what you have on the horizon? Or?
Yeah, StrozyInstitute.com. We do programs in all these areas that we're talking about here. And we have a somatic coaching track where people can become somatic coaches and work with other people this way. And we also work with NGOs, not-for-profits, corporations, government, and military in developing a somatic and embodied sensibility for leadership. And all of that is on my website, and I think much of what I've said here, too, is in my recent book, The Leadership Dojo.
Right. Well, it's really fantastic work that you're doing, and so appreciate you sharing it with the summit here. We've gotten lots of positive comments already, and I'm sure that you're going to make a big difference for folks in how they approach leadership. So thank you, Richard, for your time.
Good talking to you, Stephen.